he's written extensively on the future potential of artificial intelligence. Please give a warm welcome to Professor Tony Moore.
Great. Well, it's a really exciting time to be, as you heard in the introduction, a professor of artificial intelligence. You can't open a newspaper today without finding multiple stories about artificial intelligence. A couple of days ago, there was news broke about AlphaZero, where DeepMind, the part of Google that's been making some news, showed that they could learn how to play chess, Go, and the Japanese version of chess shogi, from nothing in a few days and eclipse thousands of years of human knowledge about the game and play at superhuman level. And another example from earlier this year, this is a friend of mine, Thomas Sandham, a professor at CMU. I've got a long running bet with him to see which of us is the worst squash player on the planet. Fortunately, I haven't got a long running bet with him to see who's the best poker player, because he's written a program with Rasis that, in some sense, is actually even more impressive than the DeepMind AlphaZero, because he plays poker better than any human. And in poker, he's got to deal with human psychology, you've got to deal with the fact that you can't see all the information, the uncertainty about how the cards get on the board. But much more like the real world than a rather artificial board game like Go or chess. But these are lots of examples. You can't not open the newspaper and find more examples of how AI is starting to infiltrate our lives. So I just want to begin, before I start talking about ethics and the future of AI, to say, well, why is it now? I mean, I spent my whole life dreaming about building machines that could think, but why is it now that we seem to be making progress? And it's not because of any real step change, any quantum change that's happened in AI. It's the convergence of four exponentials. Now, we hear a lot of mumbo-jumbo about exponentials, about how we live in exponential times, and you know, a lot of it is mumbo-jumbo because all exponentials eventually run out. But these exponentials, while they've been progressing, have been really useful. The first exponential, one that probably the whole room already knows about, even has a name. That's Moore's Law. Now, here's a graph of Moore's Law. It's the doubling of transistor count, roughly a doubling in computer power that we have every 18 months or 2 years. Now, the graph may look a little unfamiliar, because when normally you see a graph of Moore's Law, it's plotted on a logarithmic scale, 1, 10, 100, 1,000. Here I plotted it with a straightforward linear scale, and you can see how the graph really takes off at the end. And the fact that we now have, in our smartphones, more compute power that took us to the moon and back. And that's made a real difference. Things that we thought about 20 years ago, we can now do, because we just have enough processing power. We don't have it on the device, we have it up in the cloud. That's the first exponential. The second exponential, again, it's doubling every 2 years. I mean, the interesting thing is all these exponentials, they're all empirical, observational laws. There's no necessity that they are every 2 years. They just happen to be that way. And just as before we leave Moore's Law, by the way, little known fact, Moore's Law is now dead. In fact, has been so for 3 years. Intel and all the other chip companies are not trying to meet Moore's Law anymore. The only reason it happened after a while, after Gordon Moore, the co-founder of Intel, observed the fact that we had been doubling transistor count all the way back since we had vacuum tubes. That became the corporate plan of Intel and all the other chip companies to actually build the next fab plant that could actually shrink even further. Well, we're running into quantum limits, and so they're not going for a doubling in chip count. And so, since they're not going for it, no one's going to be building the fab plants. It's not going to happen. Interesting aside, Intel are going for better power consumption so that we can have more power, more compute power on our devices. But anyway, this exponential, officially now dead, but nevertheless been very useful up to now to give us a doubling in compute power. There's a similar doubling in data. And we've had, again, it's doubling every 2 years or so. With the Internet of Things, that's only going to continue. This exponential, I'm sure, could carry on for a bit longer than Moore's Law. And a lot of what we're doing in AI these days is machine learning. That needs a lot of examples. AlphaZero played more games of Go than any human could ever play in its lifetime. So it needs lots of data to learn from. But we're getting that data, right? Devices are collecting all that data. Our corporations are collecting the new gold. Of course, the new oil is data. Corporations are realizing that the most valuable thing they have is the data. And so we're having more and more of that data to learn. The third exponential is what we have been working on AI for 50 years, and we are actually improving the algorithms. Deep learning, still 25, interesting fact is the back propagation, the heart of deep learning, 25-year-old algorithm. There's been some tweaks to it. Those tweaks have been very effective. You can see the doubling in the error rate. So back in 2011, this is a standard AI benchmark image recognition. See a picture, can you name an object in that picture? There's a car, there's a pedestrian, very useful if you're building an autonomous car. Right? Back in 2011, one in four images were incorrectly labeled. Absolutely useless. You can't drive a car. One in four of the things you're seeing is not the thing you're thinking. And that's doubled to one in 10 in 2 years, and now over roughly one in 20. Interesting, there's many things in thin green lines you see at the top of that graph. That's human level performance in this benchmark. So now we can recognize images better than humans can, which is why we're going to have autonomous cars, amongst other things, very soon. And the fourth exponential, I promised you four exponentials, the fourth exponential, this is not a technological one, this is a financial one. The amount of money going into the field. It's measured by the number of dollars in VC funding, or just the straight number of deals going on. That's been roughly doubling again every 2 years. Again, that's not going to go on forever. But nevertheless, you put those four things in a pot together. You put more money, so more people working on the problems. You put better algorithms. You put more compute power and more data that can run on that compute power. You have a recipe for what we're seeing today, which is AI is starting to make lots and lots more decisions in life. Now, one thing I always have to reassure an audience like this is that the machines are not taking over anytime soon. We don't have to worry about Skynet and Terminator. Machines have the consciousness, the sentience, the desires of their own. They do what we program them to. We'll come to the consequences of that in a second. But you do not have to worry. You know, ignore what Elon Musk is tweeting about AI, please. He's a great engineer who builds fantastic cars. I'm sure he's going to get mankind to Mars. But his concerns about AI are a little overblown. We struggle to make, you know, at the moment we make idiot savants, machines that can do one task, play Go, answer Jeopardy questions, read mammograms, do one task very well. They don't do anything else than that one task. Well, one other thing that you need to not worry about, you read almost every day again that AI is going to displace all our jobs. Now we have no idea. You read lots of reports that say how many jobs. The most famous one is a report that goes back to 2013 from the University of Oxford, from Fred Osborne, that made this wonderful prediction. 47% of jobs in the United States are at risk of being automated in the next 2 decades. No one has any idea how many jobs are going to be automated in the next 2 decades. All technologies have created new jobs, and they've destroyed other jobs. We have no idea what the balance is going to be this time. Anyone who gives you a prediction, especially to the accuracy of 47%, is deceiving yourself, if not themselves. We have no idea what's it going to be. It is going to be a period of disruption, but just to understand this issue better, I'm a scientist. I went and looked at their data, right? So I looked at the data that they used, their prediction. Ironically enough, actually, they predicted the number of jobs that are going to be automated with a machine learning program. So the job of predicting who's going to be automated has now been automated. Not many people saw the irony of that. But anyway, I went and looked at the data from which that prediction was made, right? So if you put rubbish in the data, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. So one of the predictions, right? 98% chance that bicycle repair person is going to be automated in the next 2 decades. I can guarantee you. I would put lots of money on this. There is 0% chance that bicycle repair person is going to be automated. It's not 98% chance, 0% chance. For one thing, if anyone who's tried renting a bike knows it's a physically difficult thing, it's going to be immensely hard to build a robot that can do that task. It's going to be an expensive, really expensive robot. It's not something that we're going to do in the next few years. Secondly, this is not a technological one, this is again an economic argument. A bicycle repair person, unfortunately, is not a very well paid job. You're not going to put a really expensive robot in the place of a really cheap job. And the third thing, It's a sociological thing. A friend of mine owns a bicycle shop. He says, I said to him, well, what about this prediction? He just laughed. He said, we lose money repairing bikes. I said, well, why do you repair bikes then? He said, to get people in the shop, to talk to them, to sell them more kit. And so again, that's not a job that you're going to give to a robot. That's a job for a person. It's about relationships, about emotional and social intelligence. Again, something machines have none of them. So there's one example. Just one other example, just to show you how doubtful this 47% number is. Another of the predictions, 98% again, chance being automated in the next 2 decades. Model. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm not interested in how robots look in play. And with all respect to every woman in the audience, we are not going to build a robot that knows how to walk in high heels anytime soon. So there's no chance that model is going to be automated in the next 2 decades. No chance at all. So you have to treat these sorts of predictions with a lot of skepticism. But one thing is absolutely certain. There will be jobs that will be taken. Driver is one of them for sure. You're going to have autonomous cars, autonomous trucks. Anyone who earns a living driving, it's going to be far cheaper and far safer to have machines driving. So those jobs are going to disappear. And new jobs, like with every technology, new jobs will be created. That must happen in the Industrial Revolution. Most of us used to work out in the fields. New jobs were created in offices and factories that didn't exist. So new jobs were created, but one thing is absolutely certain. We know for sure, we don't know whether more jobs will be created or destroyed, but one thing we do know for sure, and that's why this room is a really important room to be having this conversation with, is that they'll require different skills than the old jobs. Absolutely certain. And therefore, and these will be technologies that are yet to be invented as well, therefore, education is going to have to become completely lifelong. It's not something that you can leave school with the skills that will last you the next 50 years of employment. It's not something you can leave university with. We're all going to be working in technologies in 20 years' time, but we're inventing in 20 years. And so we need to work out how to transform our society so that education is going to be a lifelong thing that we can do while we're on the job, even if that's part of the gig economy. One aspect of education I think we really have to start thinking about, start focusing on, is about ethics and philosophy. So, here's a question for the audience. When was the golden age of philosophy? Now, who thinks it was, Plato, Aristotle, all those bearded Greeks, those hipster Greeks? Yes? Maybe you're the school of all those continentals like, Descartes and Leibniz who helped, get us out of the Dark Ages. Or maybe you're of the school that, was it the time of Bertrand Russell, who was famously forced to be the most intelligent man alive when he was a philosopher, or Gödel and Frege and all those wonderful logicians of the turn of the century. Well, this is a trick question. Golden age of philosophy is the next 50 years. Because we're going to give machines the right to make decisions. And machines are painless. Anyone who's only done any programming, machines are painfully literal in what they do. And so we're going to have to be very explicit about what those decisions are, what the criteria, what the ethical choices those machines are making. Things that we never had to make. So we hear this all the time. We hear people often talking about things like the trolley problem, about how cars are going to be driving, autonomous cars are going to be driving along, and then they're going to face a life or death decision. They're going to have to decide whether they drive into the pedestrian who's just stepped into the road, or they drive into the brick wall, possibly killing the passenger of the car. Now, these aren't new problems. These aren't new ethical problems. We've faced for 100 years, trolley problem. Every time you've ever got in the car, at any moment in time, you might have had to solve a trolley problem. But we've never had to solve trolley problems up front and write down explicit instructions, explicit enough, that the computer could do them, that tell you what the answer to this challenging moral dilemma is. And that's just an example. I want to just have a spend a few minutes going through a couple more examples of how these difficult ethical choices are going to be entering our lives, and ones that we as a society, we need to start thinking about and actually coming up with some better answers with. And this is why it's going to be the golden age of philosophy, because philosophy's got sidetracked by it. Are there any philosophers in the audience? Philosophy's got sidetracked by thinking about language and all these irrelevant things, and now he's actually going to have to do something really practical. He's going to have to tell us how we write code, how we write programs to solve these things that we as humans have implicitly solved ourselves. As I said, any time you had gotten in a car, you may have had to solve a trolley problem. But we didn't have to code that up front. And if you had that situation, I hope it doesn't happen to you, but if that happened to you, if you survived the action, you did the wrong thing, well, you could face all those sort of charges. But that was post hoc. It wasn't something we had to think of. What are our priorities as a society up front? So here's a really fantastic example that happened, the story that broke a year or two back. This is an example of using machine learning to predict who's going to re-offend. Now, you could. So you've got a lot of historical data, you could make a prediction much better than humans predicting who could re-offend. Now, you could take such a program. This program is actually in use today in 20 of the 52 United States. You could take such a program, and you could use it to decide, well, where do we spend our limited probationary services? Where do we focus our attention to help those people most likely to re-offend, make society a safer place? So I think most people in the room would say, yeah, sounds like a good thing to do. That sounds like a useful bit of technology that can, we can spend our money more wisely, we can make society a better place, we can help the most needy people. That's not how this program is being used. It's being used to decide by judges to help them decide sentencing, parole, and bail conditions. And you think, I'm not so sure we should be handing over such a delicate decision to a machine, depriving someone of their liberty. One of the most challenging things, one of the most severe decisions we make as a society. Now, there's an absolute kicker to this story, which is, isn't it? It was showing that this program is racially biased. It's more likely to predict that black people will re-offend than they actually will. And it's more likely to predict that white people will not re-offend than they actually will. So the bottom line is that people are being kept locked up by a buggy program. And that people have been dangerously released in society because of a buggy program. Now, why is that? I'm sure the people who wrote the program didn't intend it to be racial bias. Race is not one of the inputs to the program. But postcode is. And postcode is a pretty good proxy for race. And there are neighborhoods that are largely one race and neighborhoods that are largely another race. And so, not surprisingly, it learned from the historical data. And dare I suggest, there are lots of cultural and other racial biases in the past that maybe police officers were more likely to arrest black people. Maybe judges were more likely to put black people into jail. And so we're learning from that historical data. And if we're not careful, we will bake into the program the historical racial bias that we most of us would like to get out of our society. And so we're discovering how difficult it is, even if you hand over these machines, to make sure that they're not racially biased. And then, what does it mean not to be racially biased? Because at the end of the day, maybe we're just locking people up because they're poor. And we will continue to lock up people because they're poor unless we work out how to deal with them. What do we mean by the program making a fair decision? Another very good example, this one's good because it shows how the tech companies need to wake up to their responsibility. This is Google Photos. It was discovered about a year ago. The Google Photos was unfortunately labeling. So this was the image recognition problem that we were talking about that's been done in performance. This is an example of that algorithm being used. You load your photos into Google Photos, and it can identify objects in there. And it made a very unfortunate classification in that labels of black people as gorillas. Deeply offensive. Now, it was, a few years back, the case that image recognition programs were very bad at racist and very bad at identifying, for example, black faces, because the training sets weren't very balanced. It's not clear that the training sets are not very balanced. Actually, I think what this example shows more than anything is that AI programs break in brittle ways, break in ways that humans don't break. And they have no common sense and no idea of offense.
No idea. A label white people are seals. Most white people can live with that. But black people, though, for the cultural reason, we know how deeply offensive it is to label black people as experiments. And the program has no understanding of what it's doing. Therefore, no understanding of the offense of this misclassification. I want to make one final example and then leave time for a question too. Facebook, just an example. The tech companies have been experimenting on us. Now, it used to be that they were experimenting to decide what color blue to put in the blue logo of Google. Right? Nothing very boring. But it was discovered that Facebook was actually just working out whether by changing your newsfeed, you could make people happier or sadder. Now, if I want to run an experiment on you, the public, I have to go through ethics approval, I have to get your informed consent, I have to go in front of an ethics panel. It's a big deal, it's a huge amount of work. Facebook does none of that, and did none of that. Despite that, actually, it has an academic part. They did none of that. They got no consent. When you click the button to log in, to sign up for Google, you gave them consent to do anything they like. If I told you that there were drug companies that were testing their product, knowing that it would harm people, you'd say, no, that's not allowed. It's not allowed. But somehow, we give tech companies a free ride to experiment on people. Or maybe those people got so sad, they went to committees and so on. They had no idea. There was no safety for the system at all. We give the tech companies a free ride. And the final one was this experiment to decide if you could recognize whether people were heterosexual or homosexual. Why would you do this? Terribly flawed study. But I'm going to finish there just by saying there are many positives. The machines can take us there. We make the right choices. We worry about the ethics of what we're doing. If we're informed as a population, that's where you come in. It's going to be increasingly important that we, the consumer, we, the public, are better informed as to what we should be demanding from people like the tech companies. We do have the potential to improve the productivity of our economies, to improve our healthcare, to personalize our medicine, to make us all healthy and lovely and happy. If you want to read more, I can encourage you to read my book, which is just out. Thank you very much.
I was just wondering what you thought about the Fraser Osborne predictions on people in this room, because they make what I thought was a ridiculous guess on any data set about future of educators and teachers, which they group all together into one big lump. But I just wondered if you had a view on their own predictions and mandate.
If you look at the data, they do. There are a couple of categories of teachers, as primary teacher or secondary teacher. And interesting enough, they make some completely different estimates on the different teachers on those different categories, which makes no sense at all. I think actually you're some of the safest people on the planet, right? Because education is about understanding what that person is thinking, understanding where they're at, which requires immense emotional social intelligence and understanding how to motivate that person. And sure, we're going to have lots of tools that can help us do that, and, help us, do things like mark essays. Who likes marking? No one likes marking, so we can spend more time focused on the student. And so I think, anything that involves FaceTime, any profession involves FaceTime, is one of the safest ones. That teachers are incredibly safe. I mean, and incredibly important, because we need more and more teaching, because we have to race against the machines, and therefore teaching, as I said, is a life thing. So I think teachers, if you're a teacher, you've got nothing to worry about. Their predictions were completely way off. They could make any suggestions that teachers were at risk for some of the safest jobs.
So my question is, do we have any evidence that artificial intelligence, however construed, is actually worse at ethics than humans? Or alternatively, is what you're saying that humans act in unethical ways, and sometimes this is reflected in AI?
Thank you, lovely question. Potentially, there's every reason to suppose that AI could behave more ethically. We could hold it to higher standards because it has none of our human failures. It doesn't necessarily have any self-interest, it doesn't need to want to carry on living, there's no reason why we can't hold machines up to higher standards than humans. The tech companies have sold us a complete lie that machines, the computer algorithms are unbiased. That was very convenient that they didn't want to take responsibility for their search results or anything else. Computer programs can be as biased or more biased or less biased than humans. It just matters how we design them, what data we train on. We're discovering we can make machines that could be better decisions than humans. But equally, we can make machines that can make just as bad decisions, or even worse decisions than humans. I don't know what one of these or how they train them. So, but they have the potential to be better. And that's an interesting question. You know, if ultimately we can train machines to be better at predicting, who's going to reinvent, should we then, hand that job over, the judging to machines? In 20 years' time, it's going to be illegal for most of us to drive, because machines will do it much better. For sure, we're terrible drivers. We drive when we're tired, we drive when we're drunk, we drive when we're texting. We do all these things that we know we're not supposed to do, but we do because we're human. And machines will not make all their mistakes, and they'll have much better sensors than us. They'll have radar and all these other LiDAR, all these other ways of living. We won't be allowed to drive because you'll be so much more dangerous than a human driver. So yes, there's every reason why machines will be better.
One last question.
Okay, one last question. Good catch.
Why is there this sudden habit to say they or them, this sudden anthropomorphization of things that have been around for such a long time?
It's a terrible habit, sorry, I apologize. I shouldn't do it, yes. I think it speaks to a natural tendency of ours to anthropomorphize objects. All of us, who's named their car? Most of us, many people have their car names. We have a tendency to think, and especially when they're going to be talking back to us, I like to say to people, it's going to be just like the movie Her. We're going to be talking to the machines, we're going to walk, they're going to have this conversation that follows us around, and it's going to be rather an intimate relationship. So it's going to be hard not to anthropomorphize. Which has, as you hint at, has lots of dangers, because they are machines at the end of the day. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.